Today, we are opening the 10th edition of the Economy ECA 2025 report. You know, the big annual scorecard from Google, Temasek, and Bain. Okay, let's unpack this. Our mission here, well, it's really tailored for you policy shapers listening in. We're going to dissect Southeast Asia's digital economy, particularly as it makes this huge shift. The report calls it moving from digital decade to AI reality. We really need to analyze the strategic levers, the regulatory choices, basically what's needed to unlock that next phase of sustainable growth.
And the scale here is, well, it's crucial to grasp. The research now covers all ASEAN 10 markets. That's a step up from the original C6. We're talking about a population of 614 million people. So this isn't just about looking at growth numbers. We're really tracking a decade-long transformation of, well, an entire region.
Right. And the big headline number, the one that kind of anchors this whole decade of work, is that the SEA digital economy is solidly on track to go past $300 billion in gross merchandise value in 2025. That figure is 1.5 times what they first predicted a decade ago. So that speaks volumes about the momentum, doesn't it?
It certainly does. But, you know, that success, it really brings up a critical question for you, our listeners. We've got these headwinds, global uncertainty, rising protectionism, different regulations everywhere. So how exactly can powerful new catalysts like AI keep fueling this growth and make it last? The report really tries to map out the decisions that will shape that answer.
Okay, let's start with that foundation then, keeping the growth momentum steady. The data shows sustained double-digit growth. Both GMV and revenue are up around 15% year-over-year pretty consistently. But this isn't quite the growth-at-all-costs story we saw in the early days, is it?
That's exactly the key strategic point. The report really highlights monetization discipline as the main driver now. You know, in the past, growth often came from just spending massively to get new customers. Now it seems to be driven more by deeper engagement, more sophisticated pricing, like higher prices for premium stuff, different tiers of service, and finding diverse revenue streams from the users they already have. It feels like a real shift from just grabbing market share to focusing on, well, actual profitability.
And looking at specific areas, e-commerce seems to be maturing, consolidating around the bigger players. But the real shakeup, the disruptive force, seems to be video commerce.
Oh, the explosion there is, it's really unlike anything else in the sector right now. Video commerce now accounts for, get this, 25% of total e-commerce GMV.
25%, wow.
Yeah, and just think, back in 2022, it was less than 5%. So that's a huge leap.
Okay, for policymakers listening, that rapid shift must present, well, an immediate regulatory headache, right? The report notes, this crazy growth is fueled by the number of transactions up 50% year on year, not necessarily high value per transaction, which keeps the average order value, the AOV, really low, around $6 to $7 per order, compared to, what, $11 to $13 for general e-commerce?
Exactly. And that dynamic, high volume, lots of tiny transactions, it demands new thinking from a policy perspective, you know, around consumer protection, fighting fraud, and ensuring trust in the creators. Because these video commerce ecosystems, they really rely entirely on the creators. These people are often broadcasting like 30 or more live streams every month.
That's intense.
It is. And that intensity, that reliance on the creator demonstrating the product and building trust, it really needs regulatory frameworks that can actually keep up with how fast it's moving.
Okay, shifting gears a bit. What about mobility and food? Food delivery seems to be finally turning a corner on profitability.
Yes, the report actually states food delivery is now on the cusp of profitability. And that seems to come from, well, really rigorous optimization, especially on the logistics side, cutting down the cost to serve each order. And crucially, these players are also branching out. They're expanding into higher margin alternatives, like facilitating in-restaurant dining or taking reservations. That helps offset those really steep 20-25% commissions you see on pure delivery.
Makes sense. Meanwhile, on the digital financial services side, DFS, it looks like we're seeing some genuine cross-border cooperation happening.
We really are. The foundation for regional integration is becoming incredibly strong. The report confirms that all 10 countries now have national QR payment systems. That's huge.
All 10.
And 8 of those markets now offer cross-border QR interoperability. That's through the Regional Payment Connectivity Initiative, the RPC. For businesses, you know, that just removes a massive amount of friction, making regional transactions much more seamless.
That level of technical cooperation, it sounds like trust should be, you know, soaring. But the report has this really critical, almost counterintuitive finding, doesn't it? Despite huge digital adoption, over 60% of all transactions are digital. Now, a massive 75% of users still don't trust these digital finance players as much as they trust traditional banks.
That is a staggering trust deficit. And it's a huge strategic issue for you policy shapers. I mean, if 3/4 of users are still cautious, it suggests there are these underlying worries about what happens if something goes wrong.
Yeah.
Data security, reliability. And without that foundational trust in digital finance, how can we really expect consumers to embrace AI for what the report calls those higher stakes decisions? It's a real hurdle.
Okay, here's where the next phase of growth gets really complicated and interesting. The next phase is, of course, artificial intelligence, AI. Southeast Asia's internet population is enormous, nearly 500 million users. And they lead the world in interest for AI topics about 1.3 times the global average search interest. And we're seeing incredibly high daily interaction rates in markets like Vietnam, that's 96%, and Indonesia at 94%. People are using these tools every day.
Yeah, the adoption is fast. But this transition, it's happening on multiple layers. First, you have experience redefinition, you know, where AI-assisted discovery starts changing how we find things, moving beyond just linear search. Then there's enterprise transformation AI driving operational efficiency inside businesses. But the critical piece for policymakers, the one you really need to focus on, is ecosystem enablement. That means the infrastructure, the skills, and critically, the right kind of regulation.
On the consumer side, AI is already proving useful. The report says 75% of consumers feel AI tools help them discover content and simplify tasks. That's great. But tying back to that DFS trust issue we just talked about, realizing the full potential seems to require fostering consumer trust for those higher stakes decisions. You know, letting AI handle important financial advice or maybe even medical choices, users are still very cautious about privacy, security, and frankly, whether it's reliable.
And this is where we hit what the report calls the policy paradox. It's something you policy shapers really need to grapple with right now. The first part is just fragmentation. You've got all these different regulations, or lack thereof, across the CERN region. That creates huge uncertainty and really drives up compliance costs for any company trying to integrate AI across borders.
And the maturity of those regulations varies a lot too, right?
Absolutely. The report actually classifies Singapore as the most operational in AI governance. They have working frameworks, clear direction. But most other countries in the region are still classed as emerging or even exploratory.
Yeah.
That difference in regulatory speed, it just makes deploying AI regionally incredibly complex and, frankly, expensive.
Okay. And the second part of this paradox, it's the cold, hard return on investment equation, the ROI. Which is fundamentally different in Southeast Asia compared to, say, the U.S. or Europe because labor costs are so much lower. The report pegs the weighted average wage here at about 5% of U.S. wages.
Precisely, and that changes everything. It means the main economic driver for AI adoption in the West, replacing simple labor tasks with automation, often just doesn't make financial sense here. The labor is already relatively inexpensive. So if you go and buy an expensive global large language model, that high upfront cost is really hard to justify just for automating simple tasks that a person can do quite cheaply.
So, okay, if just replacing workers isn't the main ROI here, what should the strategic direction be? What should policy encourage? Is it about subsidizing these big AI models or steering investment somewhere else?
Well, the strategic pivot really has to be towards high value creation, not just cost-saving automation. Because labor costs are low, the real ROI for AI in this region has to come from solving complex, high-impact problems that low-cost labor can't solve easily. Think about things like sophisticated, real-time fraud detection systems, or optimizing these huge, complex regional supply chains, or maybe developing hyper-personalized services that open up totally new markets. Policy needs to incentivize those kinds of complex, high-value uses, not just basic task replacement.
Right, right. Despite those hurdles, though, AI is clearly a bright spot for investors. It captured over 30% of all private funding in the region in the last 12 months. And Singapore seems to be dominating as the regional AI investment hub, pulling in about $1.3 billion, something like a 55% share of that AI funding.
Yeah. Which brings us to the overall investment climate. Private funding did see a cautious uptick, about 15%, rising to $7.7 billion. So there are signs of life returning after a tougher period. However, that capital is very concentrated. That's a key policy challenge, isn't it? How do you foster regional champions beyond just one or two hubs?
And we're seeing a definite tilt towards later stage funding, too. Series C to E plus rounds apparently account for 80% of the total funding pie. So investors are clearly backing more proven scaled businesses right now. And DFS, Digital Financial Services, continues to just soak up the funding, grabbing 45% to 50% of the total.
Mm-hmm. And investors are also looking, maybe a bit nervously, at the exit pathways. You know, how do they get their money back out eventually? While the global environment is showing some positive signs, IPO volumes are up on NASDAQ and the Hong Kong Exchange. The CCN region seems to be lagging behind that recovery. IPOs were actually down 21% here in the first half of 2025. So for you policy shapers, the challenge is creating dependable local exit pathways, ways to reward that risk-taking. Even though there's apparently a strong pipeline of over 150 potential IPO candidates across just Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore.
And we also have to address the big macro headwind hanging over everything. The region's vulnerability to global uncertainty is still high. The report explicitly states that real GDP growth forecasts have already been revised downwards across the region, and that's directly because of the announcement of new U.S. tariffs.
Yeah, this is a direct external threat that really impacts policy planning right now. Those export-oriented economies, places like Vietnam and Cambodia, they're the most exposed. Tariffs hitting potentially 19% or 20% on some goods, that's leading to significant downward revisions for their 2026 GDP growth forecasts. And even a place like Singapore, which is pretty resilient, is susceptible because its trade-to-GDP ratio is massive, something like 3-to-1.
Okay, so we've identified the $300 billion momentum, but also the DFS trust deficit. We've got the AI paradox linked to low labor costs and this global tariff uncertainty looming. It feels like all of this brings us back to the final crucial levers, the need for greater CEON cooperation. That seems essential.
Absolutely. And the source material does detail some critical cooperation initiatives that are already underway or being advanced. We mentioned the financial integration piece expanding that cross-border QR payment system, the RPC. And on the regulatory front, there's the Asian Guide on AI Governance and Ethics. That's a really vital step aimed at fostering interoperability between national frameworks, which, frankly, is probably the only way to overcome that burden of fragmented regulation we talked about earlier.
And the physical infrastructure needed for all this AI, that seems to be booming too. Southeast Asia leads the entire Asia-Pacific region in planned data center capacity growth, a projected 180% increase. Mostly private money pouring in, right?
Mostly private money, yes. But this infrastructure boom, it's bumping up against some constraints, and these are often policy-related issues. Firstly, just basic utility reliability, consistent power. Enough water for cooling these massive data centers that can be a real physical barrier in some places. And secondly, maybe even more critically for you policy shapers, are the data localization laws that exist in markets like Indonesia and Thailand.
Okay, what's the strategic trade-off there? Does forcing data to stay within national borders cripple the kind of regional AI effort that needs free-flowing data? Or does it actually succeed in fostering domestic tech champions by forcing local investment? It feels like a real tension.
It creates a massive tension. You're right. On one hand, localization aims to protect national data sovereignty and potentially boost local infrastructure players. But on the other hand, it significantly restricts the cross-border data flows that are basically the lifeblood for training large-scale AI models and driving regional innovation. Policymakers really have to balance that sovereignty impulse with the need for efficiency and scale. And the report suggests that how they resolve that regulatory tension, well, that it may be the ultimate determining factor for the region's digital economy over the next decade.
Wow. Okay, that brings us towards the end of our deep dive today. We've really watched SEA move beyond that $300 billion GMV milestone. It's clearly setting a course towards an intelligent, AI-driven economy. But the path forward seems entirely dependent on these policy choices, tackling the trust deficit, navigating that unique AI cost paradox here, and finding ways to streamline regional governance without losing national priorities.
Yeah, if we connect this to the bigger picture, perhaps the central challenge for policy shapers now is shifting the whole strategic narrative around AI in the region. Since the cost of human labor is, relatively speaking, quite low, the primary focus for AI ROI probably can't be just immediate task automation that replaces workers. It doesn't make sense economically in many cases. The real future, the real value, likely lies in using AI to solve those complex, high-impact regional problems that humans can't easily solve at scale. Things like sophisticated fraud detection across borders, optimizing incredibly complex supply chains, creating entirely new regional markets through personalization. That's where the big wins are.
So the Economy SEA report series has tracked the region through multiple challenges over the last decade: foundational growth, navigating crises, overcoming investment barriers.
And looking ahead, the source material seems to suggest that the future rests less on pure market forces this time, and maybe more on what it calls the wild card of regulatory choices. These choices can either unlock or inhibit the region's truly immense potential. Which leaves us with a final thought for you to consider. How will policymakers ensure that the critical regulatory frameworks being built now are designed not just to control, but to actively enable this next powerful wave of innovation across Xiangxun?